Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Ron Bloomberg about his new production on KSFR called Seriously Funny. Some of the actors from that radio theater comedy will be with us as well. And we'll be talking to Deborah Tang from St. Elizabeth's Shelter. I'm delighted now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Scott Fondas. He is Associate Program Director of the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York and is film critic for the LA Weekly, has been doing that for many years. And Jason Silverman from the CCA here in Santa Fe is joining us. He's the director of the Cinematheque there. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
My pleasure.
So, Jason, there is a series of films coming up that is opening this weekend. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, we have a new print of Rashomon, the Kurosawa film, and Scott will be able to tell you with more clarity, and he'll be more articulate talking about that. But obviously it's one of cinema's great masterpieces. And
Now, a new print of it, this is big news.
Yeah, the original elements were in bad shape, and so they found... They went back to the original negative, as I understand it, and did a whole bunch of work to clean it up. And so it's a real treat to have it on screen, obviously. I mean, people have seen it on TV. There's been circulating prints that have been in rough shape, so it's going to be a new experience for people who haven't seen it in other forms.
Now, Rashomon is the classic black-and-white film by Akira Kurosawa from 1950, and it's the story of a crime told from the point of view of various different people who are involved in this. Scott Fondas, what's going on with this film? Why is it still so incredibly, not only popular, but powerful today?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a film on a timeless subject, which is the subjective nature of truth. You could maybe liken it in a way to the classic courtroom drama 12 Angry Men, which actually came along several years after Rashomon. And also, of course, it's the film that really introduced Akira Kurosawa to the world stage. The movie won the Venice Film Festival. It went on to win not the best foreign language film Oscar, because they didn't have that category at the time, but it was awarded a sort of honorary Oscar for a foreign film, and it was also given awards by the National Board of Review, and it was the first of Kurosawa's films, although he had made great films before Rashomon that would be discovered by the world later. It was the first one to sort of penetrate, and it's one of these movies whose title has sort of become shorthand for a style of storytelling, which is this kind of fractured, nonlinear narrative where you have the events told out of order or recounted from multiple viewpoints. So, you know, everything from a movie like Pulp Fiction to Memento to actually a quite interesting Western from the 60s, called The Outrage by Martin Ritt with Paul Newman and Lawrence Harvey, which is a kind of uncredited remake of Rashomon, are all, descendants of this movie and indebted to this narrative conceit that Kurosawa built the story around.
So the characters in it are kind of archetypal characters, samurai, his beautiful wife, a bandit, a woodcutter, a priest, and what would you call him, a guy. And they are timeless characters. And I find it interesting that Kurosawa and this cast, what did they live together? They were very tightly involved with each other as this film was being made.
And beforehand, actually, as well. So, you know, It was a true sort of collective experience. And if you think about it in terms of what you might say Kurosawa's best-known films in the West, like The Seven Samurai and Ron and Kagamusha, This is really a very intimate film with just a few characters and really just three primary locations. It has, you know, a kind of classicism, a kind of purity to it that Kurosawa himself, you know, said was very much inspired by silent cinema. He felt that the introduction of sound into movies was such a complicated element in and of itself that with this story he wanted to keep the visuals on a very simple level. So this isn't one of, you know, Kurosawa's sprawling, epic canvases with lots of pageantry. It's really a film that's made out of a lot of close-ups on faces. There's a lot of intercutting. The number of cuts in the film is actually much more than in one of Kurosawa's ordinary films. So it's also a film that's very much about montage, which kind of enters in. You know, it relates back to this idea of subjective truth and multiple versions. Visually, he's keeping you off guard that way as well in terms of the way that the film is put together. You're never sure that the viewpoint that you're seeing something through is the truth.
And when it's all over, you're still wondering what the truth was, because when you look at these four narratives, there's no way that you can actually cobble together a truth from them. Somebody has to have been just outright either lying or deluded or something. I mean, it causes a lot of reflection on that subject.
Yeah, I think it's really a film about the way that we convince ourselves of certain things, or that we all make our own truth in a way. And you know, it's a film that questions the very existence of objectivity as a concept, which probably explains why the film has been, you know, over time, it's been a sort of favorite totem of philosophers and political scientists. And, you know, it's a kind of it's a text that's referenced in so many other texts in so many other fields that it's just really one of these sort of totemic cultural objects that's always going to be with us.
And in an era of high budget films, it is a reminder of what can be done in three simple settings with probably a very low budget. I don't know what Kurosawa's funding was like in 1950.
Yeah, I mean, it was a studio film in Japan, but it was considered by the Japanese authorities to not be particularly representative of Japanese cinema of the era. When it went to the Venice Film Festival, actually, it was done sort of surreptitiously through some back channels, and the Japanese government would have preferred to send a film by Ozu or one of the other filmmakers that they thought more sort of represented Japanese society and Japanese values, traditional Japanese values, in his film. So I think that the idea that Kurosawa was making a film about these kind of lowly characters, bandits and thieves and commoners, and this idea of you know, subjective truth in a society that's sort of known for very rigid order and that likes to have things be one way or the other, true, false, black, white, that this was sort of this was very much in conflict with that idea. And so until the film became an international sensation, it was not necessarily so highly regarded on its home turf.
It's interesting. I suppose it's hard for many of us who aren't students of Japanese culture to know how it doesn't really represent traditional Japanese values. Can you say more about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's really more about what the film is doing, you know, and the fact that that Kurosawa, you know, emphasized these kind of, let's say, characters from the lower echelons of society. In a way, the way the great director Imamura would a generation later to make films about prostitutes and low rent characters, and this was of interest to Kurosawa, where, you know, somebody like Ozu was making films about family life, about middle class characters, about the kind of more domestic side of Japanese society, and that the prism Kurosawa was choosing was not necessarily, you know, what the Japanese authorities would want to be representing their country in cinemas all across the world.
So there's the Japanese authorities had that feeling about it. What about the Japanese public? Was it as popular in Japan as it was outside?
I think that it was over time. I don't know at the time of its release how it was received, actually. I mean, it's, of course, now considered a classic all over the world. I think that as in a lot of cases, like the American films of the 1950s that were, praised by the French and then reappraised in America, that it was somewhat Western appreciation of the film that led at least Japanese critics back around to seeing this as one of Kurosawa's major films.
I just watched this film. I saw it when I was in college, and it's one of those things that you study when you take film class and all the different reasons that it's a classic and so on. And I just saw it on a VHS copy from the library on a little screen. I was thinking, this is a movie that is probably really a good idea to see on the big screen.
Well, I mean, I happen to think that pretty much every movie is best to see on the big screen. But, I mean, obviously, Kurosawa was a master of composition, of editing. His hero was John Ford. He always strove to, he always aspired to that tradition. And of course, we all know John Ford to be one of the American masters of composition, framing, editing. So I think, of course, the power of any of Kurosawa's films is enhanced by seeing them on the big screen, and this being the year of Kurosawa's centenary, I think audiences will have a lot of opportunities to do that. There's a big retrospective going on in New York right now at Film Forum, and obviously other cities around the country are getting this restored print of Rashomon. I would just actually say, in addition to what Jason said at the outset, my understanding is that the original negative of the film was destroyed in a fire at some time, I think, in the 1970s, and that this restoration is actually done from one of the best surviving prints of the film made from the negative, and that through digital processes they were able to take out all of the scratches and other blemishes, and even using several other prints, restore missing frames and that kind of thing. We don't think about the fact that a film as well known as Rashomon, with so many awards and such a half century of legacy behind it, could be in danger of being lost without proper care. And yet, something like this reminds you of the need for film restoration and preservation.
Now, you're at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. Is that something that you were involved with at that institution, restoration?
Well, we don't have an active archive or restoration division here, but we work with other organizations, helping them with that, and of course, in terms of exhibiting the finished work, which we do frequently, both in the New York Film Festival and other series that we do here throughout the year.
Scott, it seems like this film was one of a few that helped usher in a new era of cinephilia in the United States. It seemed like this is the era of the auteurs, and this is one of the first films to reach this emerging American audience. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, for example, somebody like Clint Eastwood, who would have been a young film goer at this time, and starting out as an actor, is often talked about seeing Kurosawa's films and how that expanded his sense of cinema. And, of course, he went on to star in A Fistful of Dollars, which is a remake of one of Kurosawa's films, and always felt a closeness to Kurosawa, this kind of interesting reciprocal thing, Kurosawa being influenced by John Ford, Clint Eastwood often likened to John Ford being influenced by Kurosawa. And likewise, it was sort of the beginning of wider distribution for foreign films in America, and moviegoers of the 50s and 60s then had a chance to see work from Ingmar Bergman, work from filmmakers in France. It was the beginning of the sort of American art house experience. And obviously that's something that, we now kind of take for granted, but it wasn't nearly as common in 1950.
I suppose we take it for granted, but also there was a real decline in the distribution, at least in mainstream cinemas, of foreign films at a certain point. Is the equivalent of, I don't know who's making a Kurosawa-level masterpiece in a foreign country at this time today, but are they getting seen here in the U.S.?
Well, I think they are, but I think that the channels have changed. I mean, I think now people are perhaps seeing films like this more at film festivals or in specialized organizations like the Film Society of Lincoln Center or local cinematheques and museums, and that this has in certain ways kind of supplanted the classical art house experience. You certainly have theaters that are art house cinemas now, but they may be showing more somewhat mainstream, let's say, English language art films, or if they're showing foreign films, they may be foreign films with well-known stars like Penelope Cruz or Audrey Tautou. And this idea of auteur-driven cinema, with the exception of a few very key names like Pedro Almodovar or Michael Haneke, that has kind of waned a bit in terms of its commercial viability. I mean, certainly there are directors working today who are as important as Kurosawa, and their names are just not as well known. And in some cases, it may be that their films are not quite as accessible. I mean, one of the interesting things about a film like Rashomon and about Kurosawa's work is that really it's kind of open to all audiences. He was a classical storyteller, and his films are easy to enter into. It is not to diminish their artistic value in any way, but he was a studio filmmaker. He was somebody who kind of understood that mix of art and accessibility that we might say a lot of the classic Hollywood directors like John Ford, like Alfred Hitchcock, understood. You know, how to express themselves personally while also appealing to a mainstream audience.
So you talked about the influence of the themes of Rashomon, that extreme subjectivity on American films, and really it go beyond American films. I mean, it's become iconic of the whole question of subjectivity. What about stylistically? I mean, it has a unique look, the way it's made, the cinematography, the visual qualities of it. Were those also influential on European and U.S. filmmaking?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's a film shot primarily with natural light, which is unusual. And I think that, you certainly can see that influence on perhaps a filmmaker like Terrence Malick, a filmmaker like Robert Altman, who was known to be a great fan of Rashomon. In fact, apparently, they actually had to... The one sort of unnatural thing that they did was that they had to tint the rain that you see in the movie. They had to tint it with black ink because it wouldn't register on the black and white film stock otherwise. But aside from that, they basically lit using the sun and mirrors and reflectors as opposed to any kind of artificial studio-type lighting. And I think that's one of the things that creates the kind of unique look of the film, along, as I said, with the use of close-ups, the use of montage, as opposed to, say, more longer traveling shots or that kind of thing. And I think, obviously all of that has been an influence, perhaps, in some cases for better or for worse. Certainly the use of montage has been taken to extremes by the descendants of the MTV generation, but Kurosawa uses it very skillfully to play up the idea of uncertainty and the kind of claustrophobia of the film.
Jason, this is part of a series at the Center for Contemporary Art Cinematheque. What else are we looking forward to?
We always try to bring interesting foreign films, both old and new, and we've got a good crop of them coming up. We're opening White Ribbon, which I know Scott's a big fan of, on the 19th. That's one of the Oscar nominees for in cinematography and best foreign language categories. We have a film called The Sun, Alexander Sokurov, a Russian filmmaker, We're still figuring out when we're going to play that.
Interesting film because it's a Russian filmmaker making a film on a Japanese subject, just as Kurosawa himself made Dersu Uzala a film on a Russian subject.
Right.
Interesting.
With Russian money.
Yes.
Right. Have you seen Old Partner, Scott?
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. Wonderful
yeah.
film about an old Korean couple and their cow.
We're showing that in, starting at the end of February. What else do we have? We have Ondine, which is the new Neil Jordan film with Colin Farrell coming in. Well, that's not until June. There's something else I'm forgetting. Oh, Ajami, the Israeli film, and that's another foreign language Oscar candidate. Did you see that one, Scott?
Yeah, I like that film very much. It's another film that owes something to Rashomon because it's very much using this style of the nonlinear subjective narrative. Actually, I should have mentioned it sooner, but the other recent crop of films that are very much indebted to this style of filmmaking are movies like Babel and Crash. That are sort of telling all of these different stories from different points of view, a kind of jigsaw puzzle where, you know, as the film continues, you start to understand how everything fits together. And Ajami is sort of this type of story dealing with the criminal underworld kind of setting in Israel.
Was Robert Altman a Kurosawa fan?
Well, I'm not. I don't know if he was a necessarily fan of all his work, but he was definitely known to have been a fan of Rashomon and have commented on that in interviews.
I don't want to stop talking about Rashomon without mentioning the music. The use of Ravel's Bolero is very significant in the film Rashomon.
Well, yes, and of course it's a piece that musically has a kind of cyclicality to it, which actually plays well off of this idea of this kind of rondelay in the film of going from one narrator to another to another. I mean, when you listen to Bolero, it has that kind of idea of kind of cycling, it's an interesting complement to, again, the sort of the narrative strategy of the film.
So, Rashomon, this new, beautiful, restored black-and-white print, opens this coming Friday, tomorrow, at the CCA Cinematheque here in Santa Fe.
We'll be screening it Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
Excellent. So, 4 days, you've got chances to see it. You can go to the website ccasantafe.org or call them at 505-982-1338. And it's just great to talk to you, Scott Fondas. Scott Fondas is Associate Program Director of the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York City. And Jason Silverman is Director of the Cinematheque here in Santa Fe. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
My pleasure.
This is Ricardo Perez, and this is my audition tape for the new Ron Bloomberg show, Seriously Funny. As an actor, people typecast me. But I can play many different roles. From Gone with the Wind, Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn. Or of all the gin joints in all the world she walks into mine. Get this. Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me? Let KSFR know I should be in Seriously Funny, February the 6th at 8:30 a.m. Hasta la vista, baby.
I'm very happy now to welcome Ron Bloomberg. He is a TV comedy writer, and he's been writing plays here in Santa Fe for the last 5 years.
Mary welcome. Charlotte, if this is about the pledge drive, the check is in the mail. Now, please, stop harassing me. I mean it. It's in there. You'll get it shortly.
Take two. Ron Bloomberg. No, seriously. He's an KSFR veteran. Playwright and expert at giving me a hard time.
Yeah, right.
And he is starting a new series premiering this coming Saturday, the 6th of February at 8:30 in the morning on KSFR. It's going to be rebroadcast a number of times. Welcome, if I may say so, to
Thank
the Radio
you,
Cafe.
Mary,
David Geist is here. He's a cabaret performer, actor, and he's the artistic director of Geist Cabaret at Pranzo.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Good back on the radio. And Jeannie Michaela, who is an actor and singer and also taking part in this new series called Seriously Funny. Now, Ron Blumberg, Seriously Funny, what are we talking about here? Is this radio theater?
This is, it's radio theater. Well, actually, KSFR asked me to create 4 half-hour comedy specials. And the first one will air, as you said, this Saturday morning at 8:30. But I think what's evolved, at least in the first episode, is more of an entertainment special, because we've added quite a bit of music. Now, in all 4 episodes, we're going to be following the story of William T. Tuttle, a modern-day Don Quixote driving a worn-out Chevy Camaro. And it's set in Santa Fe, and we follow William in his travels, where he will meet a number of colorful characters. And William is a prototype of so many in Santa Fe who are having a tough time finding love and steady employment, except for David. And the various storylines come together at Gus's Piano Bar, where our regulars interact. And that basically is the premise of it.
So now, William T. Tuttle is played by...
No,
Liam
not me.
Lockhart, yes.
Oh, okay.
He begged me to play the role, and I said, all right, Liam, you can play it. No, as you know, Liam is one of our best actors here in Santa Fe. And I was delighted to have him on board. And, yes, he plays William T. Tuttle.
Now, you, Jeannie, play a character named Blue Pearl, who is a writer, a waitress and a performance artist.
Yes, she's a performance artist, and I must say, I wish my parents had named me Blue Pearl.
What's she like?
Let's just say that she's been married a few times, and is still looking. And she becomes the love interest for William T. Tuttle.
Ah, yes. And perhaps a bit reluctant?
No, she, it's surprising. You would think having been married and divorced more times than she could fit on one hand, that she might be a little more reluctant. But no, she's just sort of fearless in her approach.
David, what is your role?
Well, I get to play a guy named Gus, the piano player. And boy, what a character stretch this was. I play a guy who plays piano, and he runs a music room. And, it took a lot of, I had to do a lot of research.
You had to dig deep.
I really did. I've had very little experience with this whole character.
I actually gave him method lessons for a few weeks beforehand, just
indeed,
so that he could,
Did you give him piano lessons?
No, actually. I think they flew somebody in for that, but...
The funny thing is that at the end of the show, Jeannie sings a song, a Rodgers and Hart song, To Keep My Love Alive, which is one of the wittiest Larry Hart lyrics you'll ever find. And it has to do with a woman who keeps bumping off her husband. But she and David worked on this, and it is a killer. I really have to say this. Jeannie just interpreted that lyric so beautifully. She got all the comedy out of it. It was really a terrific performance.
Thank you.
So, Ron, how do you... I know that you probably can't tell us, or it's impossible to tell us, but how do you write comedy? Do you kind of wait for stuff, or do you sit down at a desk and say, now I'm going to be funny, or what do you do?
Well, first of all, you have to have a miserable childhood. That's a prime requisite. So, those unfortunate enough to have had a happy childhood can never be comedy writers. But, in this particular case, it was wide open for me. They really just said, we need some comedy on a station, and do 4 half-hour comedy specials. And once I hit on creating a character who's kind of everyman, in 2010, with all that's going on with the economy and people in and out of jobs and relationships, and setting it in Santa Fe, it kind of opened up the door for me as far as writing it, because I just followed William T. Tuttle. And once I got David Geist, which was quite a coup, to bring his keyboard in and his amp, and, we did that all at KSFR, and it sounds like, we're doing it at a regular piano bar. That certainly helped. a great deal because it added music to it, and David did a terrific performance. So
thanks, Ron.
So it really worked well.
What are some of the comic elements? I mean, it seems like, well, maybe you can tell us, Ron. You've been around for perhaps longer than the rest of us. And were people, it seems like everybody is looking for love now. It seems like in your day, everybody just got married or hooked up with somebody and the rest was history. What's going on?
Well, your premise, I'd have to argue with a little. I don't think anything has changed. I think people were looking for love when I was looking for love in 1812. But no, I think that's just it. It's so hard to find someone. I mean, well, think about it. You have an image of someone in your mind, and God forbid that they don't come up to that image. You know, there's always something. I don't know what. But I don't think anything's changed in that area.
I guess it was useful for comedy then and now.
It sure is. It was then and it is now. And I think the thing that's changed somewhat is this economic crisis we're going through. Because it really throws people off kilter. And if people aren't working, then they're not in offices and they're not meeting their future wife. I don't know. But.
So, Jeannie, playing a comic character, what do you have to do? What is involved in, especially when you don't have the visual element, you're on radio?
You know, I think I'm fortunate because I studied music and was in music long before I ever became a professional actor. So I was one of those little four-year-old Suzuki violin children. And so I have an ear. And I have timing, and I don't know how much of that is inborn and how much of that was perhaps learned through my early training. But I think Ron will agree with this, that that's probably the most important quality to have in terms of, you know, it's like Ron does the hard part. He writes the lines. They're already funny. It's only my job not to mess them up.
You know, I saw Jeannie in a period piece.
The Last Tutor.
Yes. And she had a part of a kind of a serving maid of some sort?
Lady-in-waiting.
Lady-in-waiting. And she just killed. I mean, every line she hit, just I knew this lady had timing. And timing is the key in comedy. And she just had it. And I had to work with her. I knew I had to work with her. And so when I decided to do this, Jeannie was one of the first people I called, and fortunately, she was available. And you know, I think it's going to be good for actors here in Santa Fe. You know, there's a handful, well, a small pool of actors here in Santa Fe that could be working in L.A., in New York, in London. I've been in thousands of casting sessions, and this group that we assembled for this particular show, and I'd just like to name them quickly, if I may.
Please do.
Liam Lockhart and Jeannie and Elena Zachary, who's terrific, and Tom Romero kills. Robin Reed, we all know how good she is. William Vertiber is also exquisite timing comedically. Tom Woodward, great. And David Geis as Gus the piano player. I mean, that's a terrific group. And, they are top professionals. So, casting in this kind of thing is 75% of it. If you cast well, then you've got a show. And fortunately, I did.
Now, does improvisation play a role at all? Do they come up with things and then you change the script, or are you pretty much going with what's written?
I'd kill them if they changed a word. No.
He did threaten me beforehand. I was very afraid.
You know, originally I was thinking that if we get into the third and fourth one, that I might not write at all and just, try some improv. And I may do that. I don't know. But the first two are definitely written. First of all, we don't have a great deal of time to work on this, And somehow my staff is not with me. They must be still in L.A. But so it's a tough thing to do a half hour of this entertainment show and you know, get it done. And we're going to try and put it on every 2 weeks, the next three. So
now, are you using Foley-style sound effects so it sounds like there's all sorts of other stuff going on even when you're just in a studio?
We're using sound effects. We're using original music by someone you may have heard of, Brian Highhill.
Ah, yes. Our engineer today on this program.
Engineer superb. And he's written original music for this that is just perfect. He's a very talented young man. When I asked him where did he get this stock music, he said, no, I created it. He played all the instruments and composed it. He's really a remarkable young man, and I'm thrilled and delighted to have him.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, David Geist, have you done much acting? Obviously, we've had you on the air before. Long history as a musician, Broadway theater. What about acting?
Well, a couple of times in New York, there was actually a play I was in, Three Men on a Horse, and it was part of Tony Randall's National Actors Theater, and I played a character who was an onstage piano player.
You weren't on a horse?
Well, no, the play was called Three Men on a Horse, which was an old George Abbott play, and they had a part for an onstage piano player, so I did have some lines, and I had to sing a little bit, and that was part of the inspiration for this character, Gus. When Ron and I talked about it, I said, you know, I did a character similar to what we're going for, so a lot of my inspiration was from this character that I did during the show, Three Men on a Horse. And working in the cabaret room here in Santa Fe, I've gotten, you know, becoming more comfortable in front of the audience in terms of being a solo performer and singing more. So this was a perfect opportunity for me to use a lot of of my background and experience. And I'm playing and I'm talking while I'm playing in this radio show. So it's a great musical gig, and I get to really utilize my musical talents and my sarcasm too. For sometimes when you're in these piano rooms and people are talking, or you get these really weird requests, like this is a true story. I've had guys that have actually requested, can you play some of that Frank Lloyd Wright music?
Now,
who do you think they're talking about? Andrew Lloyd Webber. Lloyd Wright. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that happens. So it's in the show. So
and it happens to be the funniest line in the show.
Yeah, it's a good one. Thanks for giving that away.
I didn't write it. As he said, it's a true story, and it is a killer line. Thank God.
You can't write this stuff. It's that funny.
No,
so,
no.
But can I just say one thing about Ron? I'm going to sing Ron's praises.
Just one thing?
Well, a few things. No, you know, Ron and I become great friends, and we go out to breakfasts, and I mean, it's almost like Broadway Danny Rose, like the back room of the Carnegie Deli. I mean, this guy is one of the funniest.
Well, we had breakfast with Marty Markinson, who is also a theater person, a great theater person, who owns the Helen Hayes Theater in New York and some theaters in L.A., and it's like a touch of Broadway, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, but
when
these guys,
three of us get together and we talk. And
it's like the Friars Club. I mean, they cracked me up. But, you know, Ron, I don't know if you know Ron's background, but he's wrote for the TV shows All in the Family, Three's Company. Those are the ones that I can think of. But, you know, this show has the elements of Woody Allen, Larry David, you know, Jackie Mason. I mean, the best comedy in the world. And Ron has absorbed all that. He's put it into his work. We've got the influences of Ron's, you know, love of song with the Rodgers and Hart tune. So it's a wonderful world that's being created with these radio shows. And I'm really, really proud to be a part of it. And I think Ron is really, we're lucky to have him in Santa Fe. You are, you're a master at this comedy thing, Ron, and I'm thrilled to be a part of
Mary
it.
Mary Charlotte has been saying that for years.
Well, I've had your voice in the crowd on my show for years, as long as you produced with great happiness and delight. So I'm very glad that you are back on KSFR. Jeannie, you have an extraordinary background, which probably most people don't know about. Tell us a little bit about your own background in theater and everything.
Oh, I actually just kicked David under the table. I didn't know that you worked with the National Actors Theater. Yeah. Tony Randall gave me my first job when I was really young.
You know, you could have been his wife if you would have played your cards right.
Well, she was a little, aren't you funny? No, there wasn't quite that much of an age difference.
Okay.
But moving right along, I started working when I was really young on Broadway in New York, and then I moved to L.A. for a while and started working in films. Actually, my first film was with Steven Soderbergh, who is about to return here to work on his current film.
What was the film you did with Soderbergh?
It's called Fallen Angels. It was a film noir piece that was made for Showtime. Yeah, small world. And then after that, I decided I wanted to do something different. And, you know, I grew up working, so I wasn't around a lot of other people my age. I didn't really know a lot about different colleges. And I remember being about 15 and asking people, oh, you know, I think I'd like to study math and science. What are some good math and science schools? And this one girl on the show on Broadway I was doing said, oh, well, MIT. I'd never heard of MIT. I was like, MIT, what's that? And she said, well, it's a math and science school. And I said, well, is it any good? Yeah. She was like, yeah, it's the best. And I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, I was very fortunate to be able to attend MIT.
You went to MIT?
I did.
Well.
Where I discovered ice hockey, a natural progression for most people.
From Broadway to L.A. to math and science to ice hockey.
Yes.
A natural progression.
Absolutely. And of course, I decided that I wanted to see, you know, how far I could go. So I made up a list of all the schools that I thought were somewhat academically comparable, but had Division I programs. Because, of course, if you're going to play, wouldn't it be fun to play with all of the Olympians? So I transferred to Yale, and was very fortunate to be able to play with these incredible athletes. And then, of course, I ended up.
You transferred to Yale from MIT to play ice hockey?
Yes.
Yes. And then you ended up back in theater at Yale.
Right. Do you see now why Ron feels there's so much material to work with?
Who knew?
So you are Blue Pearl.
I am.
Jeannie Michaela. Now, Ron, do we get to hear your mellifluous voice in Seriously Funny?
Ron does play a character. He sort of bookends it. He plays a writer.
Who's writing a book about
not perhaps
William
as successful
Tuttle.
As he would like to be.
But there's no singing for me.
Who meets William T. Tuttle and decides to write about the life and times of William T. Tuttle.
All of this seriously funny business is happening. The premiere is this Saturday, February 6th at 8:30 in the morning on KSFR. And it's going to be rebroadcast on Wednesday the 10th at 6:30 in the evening. And then once again on Friday the 12th. At 1 in the afternoon, lots of different times to find Seriously Funny in your radio listening day here on KSFR. And Ron Blumberg, it's just great to have you back.
Do you guys know what Mary Charlotte's favorite song is? I'm one of the few people who know that. And I want to say it on the air and declare it.
What is it?
Speak Low.
Oh, yeah, that's a good song.
Curvile.
Come on, you told me you love that song.
I love that song. I do. I love that song. I love a lot of songs, but I do love that song.
Okay.
Thank you. Why are we talking about this?
I don't know. Move it to you know?
Ron Blumberg.
Yeah.
As I said before, it's great to have you back on the radio on KSFR.
Well, thanks for doing this. We appreciate it. And I hope everyone will listen in Saturday at 8:30.
And David Geist and Jeannie Michaela, thank you both so much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And maybe we'll go out with a little bit of music by Brian Highhill.
Oh, great.
I don't know what I mean, but just like hypocrisy, I don't want to act upon the things that I preach. Everything requires some level of quality, but quality just isn't me. Catch up with you. The puff's always worth the ash. Thanks to this ductile foundation, combined with the thing called imagination, the apple won't fall far from the tree. It creates a sort of ambience that only adds to the experience. Understanding everything that we see. drink to our future. Forget the past, let's cheers to everything that won't last. Cause there's not enough time for time, it moves too fast. We're all just roles waiting to be cast. And I just think the world should know the lengths that people wouldn't go. I guess humans move too slow.
I'd like now to welcome Deborah Tang. She's Executive Director of St. Elizabeth Shelter. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
So we just wanted to have a quick moment here to let people know about the benefit for St. Elizabeth. Tell us about that. That's tomorrow, February 5th.
Yes, it is, Friday. And it is going to be performed by Sangre de Cristo Chorale. It's called Songs of the Spirit, and it'll be at the Cathedral Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi on the plaza. And it's at 7:30 tomorrow night. And you can either get tickets there at the door or at St. Elizabeth's Shelter, First National Bank of Santa Fe, which is on Cordova Street, or the Cathedral Gift Shop. Or you can visit us on our website and purchase tickets that way. It's www.steshelter.org. Again, www.steshelter.org. So please, the tickets are $20. Children are free. So everybody come.
What a wonderful place to hear music.
Yeah, it's the first time that the chorale is going to be singing there, and so they're pretty excited about it, and we're really excited about it. I'm sure it will be a great program.
Have you been faring during this snowy weather?
We have seen so many people. Both, we have a new shelter, Casa Familia, that is for women and families, and it is full, and our emergency shelter for men is full as well. So it's been a tough winter. It's been the coldest one I have experienced.
And making it all the more important to support St. Elizabeth's Shelter. Deborah Tang, thank you so much for letting us know about this, and we will see you at the Cathedral in downtown Santa Fe tomorrow night.
Thank you so very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, speaking of the arts. Linda Siegel with her legislative update and much more. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz.